from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It's past time to act in Syria. That, according to the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. We begin with this report from Stephanie Kutrix at the United Nations.
Immediate action must be taken to protect civilians in the northern Syrian town of Ain el-Arab, according to the Secretary General of the United Nations. The UN chief is urgently calling on all those who can to protect people from the terrorist group ISIL. Ain el-Arab, also known as Kobani, is reportedly very close to being captured by the Islamist militant group ISIL, who have led what Mr. Ban described as a barbarous campaign, resulting in numerous deaths and injuries. Ban Ki-moon says he is following with grave concern the ongoing offensive by ISIL, which is committing gross and extensive violations of human rights and international law. He says massive displacements of civilians have also taken place in Turkey. On Tuesday, warplanes from a U.S.-led coalition fighting the militants have reportedly been striking targets in support of Kurdish forces battling the terrorist group. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Those U.S. attacks on Syria's infrastructure, ostensibly intended to deny its use by ISIL, also follows a conventional line of attack against the Syrian government, which, unlike the foreign-backed opposition groups, is responsible for delivering essential services such as power, water and sewer, police and fire protection, and health care, among others, to the population of Syria. The targeting of both sides, or more, in a conflict is a novelty in military actions, leaving many observers wondering exactly whom the U.S. is really targeting. RT's Igor Piskunov has more.
With U.S.-led airstrikes on ISIS positions in Iraq and Syria in full throttle, President Obama promises there will be no American troops on the ground.
As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq.
The lawmakers agree but are stressing airstrikes alone is not a strategy.
The president's made clear that he doesn't want U.S. boots on the ground. Well, somebody's boots have to be on the ground.
So instead of deploying American forces,
both the House and the Senate have now voted to support a key element of our strategy, our plan to train and equip the opposition in Syria so they can help push back these terrorists.
Among the forces Washington's placing its bet on are the Syrian rebels.
We can provide them a place to organize inside Syria. We can give them the heavy weapons that they need
to
combat tanks.
Who's them?
I know them. I've met them. They're there.
It still hasn't been decided who exactly will be in charge of filtering the moderate rebels from the radical ones or how it will be conducted. But the State Department also seems quite confident in the idea.
I just don't agree that a majority are al-Qaeda and the bad guys. That's not true. There are about 70 to 100,000 oppositionists, about somewhere maybe 15 to 25% might be in one group or another who are what we would deem to be bad guys.
Yet some former Pentagon officials aren't so optimistic.
The fact that we're going to allow, that we're going to be training Free Syrian Army inside, many of whom have already shown that they are integrated by these foreign fighters, it makes this entire approach, this entire strategic plan, a failure and doomed from the get-go.
ISIS itself, which now roams through large chunks of Iraq and Syria, is believed to have partially grown out of radical rebel groups in the country, and a large part of its massive weapons stock is either intercepted or captured aid to the opposition. Raising fears, the administration may be on the verge of stepping on the same rake.
The Pentagon reportedly aims to put together a proxy force of at least 5,000 rebels who are going to be given cash and heavy weaponry to fight ISIS. And it still may not be known who's going to head the program, but it is clear picking out the right fighters for the job won't be easy. Many Syrian rebel groups are known to have ties with radical Islamic factions, so both the funds and the arms could easily end up in the wrong hands once again. Igor Piskunov, RT, Washington.
We'll hear more about the actual intended purpose of U.S. intervention in Syria from Sarah Flounders, director of the International Action Center, later in this newscast. Turkey, which adjoins Syria to the north, has been a staging area for the training of anti-government fighters since the U.S.-backed war against Damascus began in 2011. But as of late, the spillover from Syria, which began as a flow of refugees, has begun to take on the form of actual fighting in and around Turkey. Analyst Soraya Ulrich spoke with Press TV about some of the impacts the fighting in Syria is having on this member of NATO.
The Iraq invasion was to have been a launch pad to then invade Iran and Syria. But each country, I mean, why would Turkey cooperate when it's we know from past wars that every war has its spillover, and Turkey will not remain immune from this. And we already see the demonstrations and the uprisings. So there will be a big price to pay for Turkey as well. But it seems that these countries that are allied with the United States and its grand plans in the region, it's never about the people of those countries. It's always about the leaders, and leaders always end up winning. Whether how long-lived their win is a matter of dispute. I mean, Mubarak was gotten rid of because his time was up, as was the Shah of Iran. So, you know, they will end up losing, and they will not stay in power for long. The people will eventually turn on them. And it's mind-boggling that they should think they can be safe from all this by giving these sacrificial lambs to the foreign powers to invade and kill so that they can occupy those nations. I think for Turkey, it's probably a matter of being allied with a superpower, which is fast on the decline. And of course, there's profit to be made. I mean, they get a nice change from the United States military change. They get all sorts of aid. And you know, if they manage to sell their precious water to Israel, when there's all the more money in their pocket. But I ought to mention here that all these plannings date back to the year 2000, when Turkey and Israel actually had negotiated a deal whereby Israel would buy water from Turkey. And it proved not to be cost effective because they couldn't send water with tankers to Israel. And at that point, ISPS, which is an Israeli-based think tank, presented a policy paper. And this is the same think tank that that has given the blueprint for the invasion of Iraq to Mr. Netanyahu. So in 1996, they presented a policy paper calling for geopolitics of water, which called for ground invasion, military troops, international coordinated military troops inside Syria so that they could pass pipelines from Turkey to go through and supply Israel with water. Turkey, by refusing to take action and allowing the slaughter of the Kurds, in fact, is killing two birds with one stone. One, well, they're getting rid of the Kurds, which they've always oppressed. And secondly, he's sending an open invitation to NATO to invade another country, Syria. And this has been in the making for years. Turkey has been very complicit. And we know that Senator McCain went and visited the terrorist through Turkey. And Turkey's been allowing armed terrorists to go through to Syria. So Turkey is actually benefiting from this. Not only are the Kurds being eliminated, but also its plan of cooperating with Israel and giving it water. And of course, and at that time, it was actually thought that they should overthrow Assad had just taken on the presidency. So these plans have been in the making for years and years. And now, by standing by, allowing the Kurds to be slaughtered, they can appeal to the humanitarian aspect of the NATO countries as well to interfere.
For its part, the Syrian government has been making slow but steady progress in reclaiming territory that had been taken by the anti-government fighters. Press TV's Ala Abraham reports from just outside Damascus.
Shattered buildings still stand here, bearing witness to a relentless fight that ended when the Syrian army took the town in a surprisingly swift operation. After many have thought rebels will hold this town as a close point of entry to Damascus.
We're standing in the Khaniya district near Damascus, where the insurgents have moved in on the neighborhood earlier in September to release some of the pressure that the Syrian army was putting on Jobar district, also near the Syrian capital, Damascus. As you can see behind me, the level of destruction indicates the intensity of battles that took place here. The Syrian army is pressing ahead with its operations in the nearby Ayn Tarma Valley and says that it won't stop until it regains full control over the eastern Ghouta district.
Militants from Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria took this residential area, which is known to be a stronghold for government loyalists, who fled their houses with only the clothes on their backs. Today, they returned to pick up what is left amid the ruins after the army regained their whereabouts.
The Syrian Arab Army, along with National Defense Forces, have successfully regained the area of Duhania. We discovered in the area a weapons depot and supply tunnels. The terrorists were planning to use this area to launch a large-scale attack on Damascus City. During their attack, the gunmen abducted a number of civilians. We freed some of them, while the rest are still unaccounted for.
The battle ahead is Ayn Tarma. One of the commanders explains the challenges that the future will carry.
As you can see on the map, this is Ayn Tarma Valley. They have pulled back into their blocks and buildings on the other side of the valley. We are devising plans now to further pursue them. We want to benefit from the momentum of our gains in Adra, Alamalia, and now Aduhania. We know they have established strong defense lines with explosive devices and tunnels, but now we have some surprises for them too.
Syrian tanks press forward. No time to rest for these units. The mission is not yet accomplished to the full. To secure the perimeter of Damascus and eliminate all militant presence in the area. A mission that no doubt will not be easy. Ala Ibrahim, Press TV, Damascus Countryside.
Another African leader is before the International Criminal Court, a venue referred to by many in Africa as the International Criminal Court for Africans due to its almost exclusive prosecutions targeting the continent's leaders. Daniel Dickinson reports.
The Kenyan president Uhuru Kenyatta has come before the UN-backed International Criminal Court, or ICC, in The Hague in the Netherlands on Wednesday. President Kenyatta is the first sitting president to appear before the chamber. He faces charges of crimes against humanity in connection with post-election violence in Kenya in 2007 and 2008. Kuniko Ozaki is the judge who presided Wednesday's hearing. She spoke directly to President Kenyatta.
This hearing has been convened to address matters of fundamental importance, which impact directly on your rights as an accused, as well as the interests of victims and witnesses in this case.
The ICC says President Kenyatta is allegedly criminally responsible as an indirect co-perpetrator of murder, deportation, rape, persecution, and other inhumane acts. The violence left more than 1,100 people dead and forced 600,000 to flee their homes. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
The streets are calm in Hong Kong after many days of protests, but the effects are still being felt in a number of areas, including the city's government. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Hong Kong legislators have postponed their council meeting for a week out of concerns that protesters might block access to the government complex, which could lead to a confrontation. The meeting was scheduled for Wednesday, and the agenda included the discussion of the Occupy Central movement and how police handled the protests.
Because the entrance to the car park at the Legislative Council built for officials and council members cannot be secured, they would need to walk to the building and there are concerns for their safety.
As the U.S. digs itself deeper into the fighting in both Syria and Iraq, pundits here are busy assigning blame for the mistakes they claim led to this point. But not everyone agrees that the situation the U.S. is in is the result of mistakes, or, in any event, unintentional. Sarah Flounders is the director of the International Action Center in New York. She spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford about the president, U.S. policy, ISIL, and more.
It's not really mistakes that the U.S. makes, although they do have totally contradictory policies that fail again and again. And so it can seem misguided. The problem is that they are at war with the world and having to constantly hide their aims and their goals and can turn on the very forces that they create. So all things can be true, but what they're telling the people of the world is always a lie, always. We should know, as Kissinger said, there are no friends, only interests. So their relationship with ISIS can change. Certainly, it's very clear that the U.S. government policy and Wall Street's policy is determined for regime change in Syria and totally hostile to the government in Syria. So the policy is contradictory because they failed in 3 years to overturn the government of Syria. And they failed to get UN Security Council support. They even failed to get NATO support. The British Parliament voted against going to war with Syria. And Obama last year had to withdraw from any congressional vote because it was clear it wouldn't pass. So they're going at it by a different angle now. It's very dangerous, this new bombing campaign within the sovereign state of Syria, at no request, of course, from the Syrian government and with no authorization of anyone. Obama has set up a new coalition of the willing, which is quite an amazing thing. It's the Arab monarchies, these corrupt, feudal, ruthless, repressive regimes that actually routinely use decapitation against the movement within their own country. Saudi Arabia publicly decapitates on average one person a day, hundreds of people a year. So because two U.S. journalists were decapitated by ISIS, suddenly Saudi Arabia will be training the Free Syrian Army, these very forces that they have been arming. And Saudi Arabia has also been arming. The conduit for arming ISIS has been through Saudi Arabia. So a completely contradictory policy if we're expecting it to be rational. But it's a policy all based on public lies for the media. And that's what we have to keep constantly in mind. What they're saying and what they're doing is totally at odds. It's really U.S. power in decline and in decay, less and less able to control events, wildly thrashing out without a clear idea of what it's doing. And at the same time, the anti-war movement here and forces around the world need to know that the real opponents that for so long the U.S. has been determined to destroy and attempted at every point to undermine are Syria, the resistance in Lebanon led by Hezbollah, the Palestinian movement, Iran in the Middle East because of its strong economic standing and position. These are the real targets if U.S. government and U.S. corporate power is going to control the region. So ISIS is a temporary public relations target. They may be worried because always their policy that gives rise to new forms, new hatreds, who really did so much to create Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and the Taliban in Afghanistan was U.S. wars, sectarian policies, the divisions that they set in motion. So at this point, they're claiming to fight ISIS, but we need to keep in mind who their real targets are and what they're attempting to do. They want to go back into Iraq. They want to be back in and overturn the government in Syria. They want to divide up Lebanon. These have always been their stated policies. But right now, because they whipped up a campaign against ISIS, the Islamic State, that provides them the entree. And we shouldn't believe it for a minute.
You said that in a larger sense, the United States is at war with the world. What do you mean?
The U.S. position in production, in communications, in technology, in market share has shrunk at the end of World War II. 5-6% of the world population and more than 50% of all productive capacity. That has now shrunk and shrunk again. And in every area except for military dominance, 1,000 bases around the world, the ability in one launch to end life on Earth, the only area where they are dominant is in their military. And so it becomes again and again the weapon of choice in a desperate effort to reestablish their global economic political position. And that won't work. The idea that they can encircle China, encircle Russia, expand NATO, and carry on a five-pronged war in the Middle East, it is without reality. while carrying on a military action almost every day somewhere in Africa, maintaining 1,000 bases around the world at a time when there's a shrinking economy here. It's disastrous for working people here in the U.S., paying the costs of all of these wars and knowing that more than half of the federal budget every year goes to the military. And it's the only part, it's the only expense that increases 5 to 10% a year, whereas every social program is cut 5 to 10% a year. So look at New York City, where this is by New York's own estimate. 20% of the population relies on food pantries, free food, food kitchens in order to eat. And a third of the families with children rely on free food handouts. That's a growing poverty. That's really part of life everywhere in the U.S. Water shutoffs that will reach 300,000 in Detroit, or a militarized army such as we see in Ferguson. This war with the world comes home here, and it is less and less able to succeed around the world because they continue to create new layers of hatred and destruction. It's not succeeding, and yet it's terribly destructive for the region when you look at what they've done to Iraq and what they're doing in Syria, where a third of the population are now displaced refugees. So it's a policy of havoc and a failed policy. Both things are true.
Given what you've said, the more the U.S., because of its own internal contradictions, shrinks in terms of everything except its military, the more wars, active confrontations we can expect.
That's right. It's because it's their only weapon, you could say, their only way of asserting their dominance is through military means. I think best example was the NATO meeting just last month in Wales, where in the space of a week, it opened with this claim that Russian troops and Russian tanks were invading the Ukraine. They claimed they had satellite images. This was actually asserted by President Obama. And the OSCE, their special monitors, put out a public statement saying, we're right at the border, and there's no Russian troops, and there's no Russian tanks, and no one has crossed over. Now, it's really pretty incredible when the OSCE, which has helped to create as monitors, contradicts the head of state in the U.S. But it was an example of this contradictory and impossible policy, because even the European Union, the European countries, feared the implications of this. They grasped immediately at Putin's proposal of a ceasefire. So that was one thing going on at the NATO meeting. The other was ISIS, where Obama tried to line up even NATO to join in this war on ISIS. And NATO, this is a U.S.-commanded military alliance, they refused. So we had to go for this flimsy coalition of the willing, where a bunch of countries have signed on, but they said, well, we won't have any troops and we won't have any aircraft. Big deal. In the midst of it, they're in the midst of also negotiations with Iran, the 5.1, during this meeting in NATO, and they suddenly announced new sanctions on Iran on 25 major oil and banking companies in Iran, right in the middle of their negotiations with Iran. Each of these policies are contradictory, and ISIS is one example, but it's happening everywhere they put their finger.
So it seems that the more the United States flails about, the more isolated it becomes.
Absolutely, the more isolated it becomes, and the more other countries see if there isn't some way they can economically move forward, not on a necessarily a new or progressive basis, but even on the basis of trade and exchange, because they fear the endless demands for sanctions or new wars put the whole world at danger and also put their own economies at danger. They don't have things that they want from the U.S., and more they fear this contradictory policy. Here you have a president awarded rather optimistically the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, ran on a peace platform, and yet carrying out the very same policies as Bush, and using the same terminology. It shows it's not just neocons. This is U.S. policy today, wildly contradictory, dangerous, not very successful, and massively destructive.
For more on the question of whether or not the United States finds itself in the situation it's in Iraq and Syria as the result of a mistake, we go to Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Radio for this commentary.
You know that an American military adventure is going very badly when the conversation turns to the mistakes of U.S. intelligence agencies. Usually, Washington starts scapegoating its spies after its wars have failed to achieve their objectives, as happened in Iraq when the natives failed to greet the American invaders with rose petals and bottomless gratitude, and in Vietnam where the awesome U.S. war machine slaughtered 3 million people but still could not subdue a third world country's quest for independence. America files all of its failures under the heading of mistakes after the fact. But President Obama has essentially inaugurated his bombing campaign in Syria with an admission of past mistakes, telling 60 Minutes that the CIA underestimated the strength of ISIS. What Obama's admission actually shows is that the real U.S. mission in Syria, the 3-year proxy war to overthrow the government of Bashar Assad, is already a failure. Obama has thus been forced, by failure, to mount a far more conventional, although equally illegal, air war in a desperate bid to rescue his original mission of regime change. The president is, in fact, apologizing for the CIA's loss of control over ISIS and the other jihadists that Obama and his Arab and Turkish allies sent to bring chaos to Syria. Obama thought his intelligence services could calibrate and control the bloodbath they had spent billions to inflict on Syria, that they could regulate and direct the Islamist fighters' death-embracing furies like a well-engineered nuclear reactor. Instead, and inevitably, what Obama and his allies got was a meltdown, a China syndrome of holy war that has left Washington's regime change by proxy scheme in ashes. Much of the left in the United States is also suffering from a kind of intelligence deficit, failing to understand the magnitude of the crisis now confronting U.S. imperialism in the Arab and Muslim world. Washington's jihadist foot soldiers have struck out on their own mission. Not only does the U.S. have no force to replace these Islamist warriors, it must now kill enough of them to retain some imperial authority in the region, but not so many as to ignite a general jihad against America and its allies. Plus, under these new and infinitely more complex conditions, Obama must also find a way to bring down the Syrian government. U.S. imperialism has been deeply and irrevocably weakened by the revolt of the jihadists, which is the logical and predictable result of U.S. policy in the region since the overthrow of President Mubarak in Egypt and the bombing of Libya. In fact, I did predict it back in February of 2011. No matter what the United States does, the crisis will deepen, directly threatening the viability of the Arab monarchies on which the West depends to control the price and availability of oil. However, just because the U.S. has no good options doesn't mean it has no options at all. Superpowers always have options. They have the immense ability to destroy things. For example, Damascus, the capital of Syria, could be obliterated. But such a crime would be evidence of the weakness, not the strength, of U.S. empire. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.